When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I woke up this morning
All Things Blues and Southern Rock Podcast, a Southern Storm of bold, liberating rock, shot through with blues, soul, and gospel. And now, your hosts for the show, Brian Jones and Jason Johannes.
Welcome to another episode of the All Things Blues and Southern Rock Podcast, now on Pantheon Podcast. Go there, find your favorite music podcast, which of course is the All Things Blues and Southern Rock Podcast.
Find your second favorite podcast, Brian, because we are their favorite.
That's what I just said. We're their favorite. So go find your second favorite. What's going on, man?
Well, I know this episode is going to come out later. We're recording on September 6th. I'm going to go see our recent podcast guest, Emily Wolf, play tonight in Columbus. So looking forward to that. What's going on with you?
Not too much, man. Going to see them, Dirty Roses, next week on the 13th. Nice. Same place in Henriette, Minnesota, where Northwoods Jam is. So I'm really looking forward to that, seeing those guys for the second time.
And they keep getting better as a live band. They were really good, but I've seen them play once or twice every year for the last 3 years, and they just keep improving as a band. They are a band that you got to see live to appreciate for sure.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, we got some things going on here. A couple, two, three things, you know, I mean, so how drunk do you have to be to get kicked out of Kid Rock's bar?
How drunk do you have to be to get into Kid Rock's bar?
Our buddy Steve Gorman posted that on Twitter. Some person was so drunk they got thrown out of Kid Rock's bar.
Twice in the same night.
That's astonishing.
It's pretty sad.
You know, it's astonishing, it's but mostly sad.
We're going to laugh at it anyway. It's astonishingly sad, Brian.
So next thing, I'm not a fan of Taylor Swift's music, but I think she's kind of a badass because I don't have all these like details perfectly, but it was like she's doing like a tour movie, or what is she doing where she's doing it, paying it all for herself, for her organization. And whoever the companies were in Hollywood that wanted to get involved in it are kind of a bit hurt about that they didn't get in on it. She's like, you know.
Fuck the system. She's great. She also was fighting about Ticketmaster and all the things it took to get through tickets at the same time, too. So she definitely doesn't mind ruffling a few feathers because, well, she's a juggernaut. I don't think there's a whole lot of people that can contend with her right now in terms of her and Harry Styles. I think maybe maybe the it thing's going.
That's interesting. But like, so where do you, like, what genre is Harry Styles considered? I mean, like, I don't
pop. Up with... He's straight up pop. My daughter loves both of those artists. She's seen them play. What I will say is I respect and appreciate both of them. Harry Styles does have some good pop songs overall. He's not really, but they're both talented and he's a hell of a performer, but I also wouldn't go see him in concert. I just pay for my daughter to do it.
So she, no, Taylor Swift only plays stadiums, right? Or does she play arenas?
That's what she's doing right now. Yeah. Yep. She came through Cincinnati, played Paul Brown Stadium where the Bengals play. I know she's been hitting the big, kind of like with the stadium tour with like Crew and Def Leppard's doing. She's kind of following that same path.
And I'm trying to, remember how many people actually just only play stadiums, because my buddy Gene just saw, and his wife saw Pearl Jam, but they saw it at the XL Energy Center where the Minnesota Wild plays. So they play arenas. You know, Metallica plays stadiums only.
Metallica, U2.
Foo Fighters. Are they just stadiums now, pretty much?
Yeah. There's a handful, and it's mostly like legacy bands, like people that have been around a long time. So, I mean, I guess Taylor Swift and Harry Styles, I mean, they've been around. I mean, Harry Styles, I think, was in One Direction, which was like that popular boy band for a bit. But most people playing stadiums these days have been established artists for a long time.
Wow. And talking about established artists have been around a long time that probably kicked the door open for everybody else to play stadiums. When these guys come out with a new song, a new record, like everything else, it doesn't matter when it is, doesn't matter what's in fashion. Everybody kind of stops and just like can only pay attention to one thing. And that's, we got a new Stone song out today called Angry, got a new record October 20th. Whenever this happens, it's quite the big deal. And, I know we're going to do episode or two leading up to it and probably do an episode on release day, but, I like the new song. It sounds like, the guitars are back up front where they should be in the sound. And it's been that way for a while, but I've been predicting this to everybody. This is going to be the best Stones album of original material since Tattoo You, which was 1981.
What makes you think that?
Well, I think they're just getting back to where, they've, obviously like in the 80s and the 90s, those kind of big stadium shows had the gigantic stage show and all. There was just a lot of fancy kind of stuff and fanfare and sensationalism and stuff. And on the last few Stones tours, it's just them, their back line, and just the stage. There's not a whole lot of other distraction. And I think it's like a full circle thing, like getting back to where they started, like remembering, they started out like as a, their interpretation of blues, during the 80s, you had all this, Emotional Rescue and Undercover and all that kind of stuff. And in the 80s, a lot of people went down that path, So
yeah,
I'm hoping
that was my least favorite decade from the Stones, probably.
To some extent. But I mean, every conversation we have kind of like is a good segue into that. You're talking about the 80s, but so we got a guest coming up, and I'm going to do this long kind of intro in it that we probably didn't have time when we talked to our guest, but it was around like the summer of 1986. And my buddy, Don Wyatt, who was a contributor to the page.
He comments all the time.
Yeah. He had a 1974 Mustang II, the glorified Pinto. Sparkle red. He'd do his own kind of pinstriping, like, and on the windows too, across the front of the windshield, he had written Auto Blast. And so that summer of 1986, there was another record from that same band where that song came from, and we listened to that record, that second record, over and over and over and over, and it was just like absolutely the soundtrack to the summer after sophomore year in high school. And we're talking about Black and Blue. First record was self-titled. The second record, Without Love, was, we've got Mr. Jamie St. James on as a guest. We're going to go in a deep dive on that record. But I think, that's their best record, and other people have said the same.
It certainly has, I think, their biggest radio or MTV hits off of it. Miss Mystery, Without Love, those are always on the radio. If you listen like the Hair Nation channel on SiriusXM, they're always on. They're great. They're catchy. And Brian, we always gravitate towards blues-based rock as it is. And those guys certainly have that.
For sure. That's the kind of guitar player Tommy Thayer is, was and is. He wasn't a big flashy kind of guitar player. And I always thought of them, Black and Blue, more of a hard rock band than, kind of a metal band or a glam metal.
Well, they're like in the Tesla band range, right?
Somewhere
like
around Tesla there, yeah.
Kind of
LA Guns, like, you're wearing the shirt, LA Guns, and we mentioned Junkyard and Cinderella, and they're in that camp.
Yeah, and I'm always, happy when we have an episode that you certainly love and are passionate about because this band meant so much to you. Is everybody's going to hear when we get in the conversation with Jamie C. It's like, I'm excited because you're excited. You know what I mean?
And, you know, I'm excited about everybody, but like, I have to admit, as long as we've been doing this, the first time we talked to Steve Gorman, I was a little bit like, but I mean, like, just kind of like,
you're nervous because you respect and reverence with the artist.
This time was totally like, I'm just like, oh, I'm talking to Jamie St. James. I can't believe that.
Well, everybody's going to find out that it was a great conversation and you didn't make a fool of yourself. So here we go.
What a great guy, man. I'm so glad I got to talk to him. He's just super nice. Awesome. Full circle moment. So you guys kick back, relax, and listen to our conversation with Jamie St. James from Black and Blue. Here at the guest segment of the podcast, and usually I throw over to Jason to introduce the guest that we told you about, but I'm going to take this one, and I think Jason's pretty cool about, but we got someone here. We told you in the intro, we did a long build up to that, but this is really awesome for me. This guy and his band is specifically those first two records were the soundtrack of my like sophomore year in high school, and you know, we just listen to him over and over and over. So we have the one and only Jamie St. James, lead singer from Black and Blue. How are you doing today, brother?
Ha ha! I'm alive. I'm alive and well.
You're in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, I'm outside of Los Angeles. I'm east of LA, out by like the San Bernardino area under Mount Baldy. Oh, yeah. I like it out here. So I'm
right on. Cool.
I'm 30, 40 minutes east of LA proper.
Yeah. How long you been out there?
Oh, 15 years.
15 years. Okay, right on. Well, first of all, we should thank Andrew Daly, our good friend, rock journalist, for making this all possible. Thank you, Andrew. This is huge for me. So, you know, we want to talk mostly about the Without Love album and, you know, maybe a little bit about your Cheap Trick tribute band. But I'd like to start out, you know, and this is mostly, you know, I've read a lot about you guys over the years and kept up with stuff. And I've been basically referencing to Andrew's, you know, chats with you, but now this is like pre Black and Blue. Like you had been going out to LA since 1978. And do you think those were like scouting trips at all for you? You knew you were going to go there. You just were waiting for the right combination of guys.
Yeah. For me, it definitely was that. I was 16 years old so it was actually 1976. The first time I went to LA, I know that cause I just got my driver's license, and me and my friend Julian Raymond, who has done a lot of stuff musically since then, we were in a band together back then, but he ended up being like vice president of A&R at Capitol Records. He just produced many things like stuff for Brian May and Queen, Cheap Trick. He's produced a lot of stuff. He was managing Glenn Campbell at the end of his career. So he went on to do a million things. He's a great guy and great songwriter as well. But anyway, we got in a car. We borrowed a green Pinto station wagon. And we said, can we borrow your car for the weekend? And we took it to L.A. He didn't know that, but we did.
From Portland? And, you drove from Portland down to L.A.?
From Portland to L.A. Got my license, and that was my ticket to go. And we drove down, and we knew we were going to go to the Starwood to see whatever band was there. That was one of the big clubs in L.A. back then. And there was, we saw a lot of bands. We saw Yesterday and Today. It was either that trip or the trip after, you know, that turned into YNT. But anyway, yeah, definitely we wanted to see what the scene was like down in LA, down here, because I knew Portland was going to be tough.
Once you got like the lineup, main lineup together, before you guys left, you know, were you guys like the biggest band in Portland then, or is that
no?
You guys are no? Okay.
No, we weren't. Because when we were playing the clubs, we would play a lot of original music, and they don't want that. We were loud. And when we would play cover songs, everybody's playing Foreigner and Cat Scratch Fever, Ted Nugent, and stuff like that. Well, when Black and Blues started playing, what was our, I mean, our cover tune was Motorcycle Man, Saxon. We were playing heavy stuff. We played Aerosmith and AC/DC and that kind of thing. We didn't play all the hits. We played just stuff we liked. So anyway, I had been playing clubs since I was about 16, 17 years old. So Black and Blue didn't get together until 1981. So I was 21 by then. But we weren't the biggest band in Portland. We could get gigs, but not that much, you know? So that was one of the reasons why I knew we had to leave.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Right. So it was already predetermined you guys were going to go there. You had your lineup and you went there. And I've always tried to imagine that, the Sunset Strip at the beginning, it was something that you just had to be there to see. You probably can't really put it into words. And it's maybe not an equal comparison, but I mean, I've always thought that, like, with certain events like Woodstock as well. So, the Sunset Strip, I just imagine, was it kind of like what Las Vegas Boulevard is now, but just with bands, with musicians? Was it like a constant flow of?
Well, yeah, because look, I was down there before that, right at the beginning of it, and even beforehand. But when I got, it's true, the Sunset Boulevard, because of the Rainbow and the Roxy and the whiskey right there, was an insane asylum, because Orin Gazari's was there too, so everybody would. Just every telephone pole and metal pole, whatever it was plastered with flyers. You would find a girl that would hand out your flyers. You would just print out flyers, and everybody's just trying to go get everybody to go to everybody's shows. And at 2 in the morning, the Rainbow would close, the whiskey would be shut down, everything's shut down, but it still would go on till 3, 4 in the morning. Cops would come by because it would flow out into Sunset Boulevard, and they'd have to, to get out of here, everybody, and the party just kept on going or whatever. But so, it is what people think it was, it was nuts. It was everybody dressed up crazy and doing their thing. And every band was out there, and 1,000 girls, all of their studded bra tops or whatever the hell they were wearing, it was fun.
It would seem like, obviously, like a lot of people went out there and, came back with shattered dreams or whatever. And maybe part of that was, maybe they didn't have it, but isn't another part of it like, how soon do you guys realize that this is a business too? You can talk about the parties and the chicks and all that, but is that a big part of it? Like, guys just didn't realize like how much of your band is also a business.
Well, let me tell you something. We weren't there for the party and all that stuff. We were
right.
Owning our craft up in Portland. We were writing songs. We knew songwriting was the big deal. That's how I learned to play guitar, essentially, so I could help write songs, But Tommy Thayer and myself were pretty good at putting songs together. We were real good. So we were constantly rehearsing, getting things together. We would take a couple of trips down. We would book shows in LA through Dee Dee Keel, who worked at the Whiskey, and she hooked us up, got us booked at the Troubadour and the Whiskey. I think our first run, we played. We book shows, come down from Portland, go back, and finally we ended up moving down to LA. But we knew it was, look, there was a lot of good bands, and we were going to be one of them. And we was rehearsed constantly. We had a big band house. We had a management that was the first thing we got before anything. And he believed in us and kind of helped us. He rented us a house and we got rehearsal rooms because we didn't have any money. We first moved down, we slept on people's floors and on their couches, just people we knew down here. Yeah, we were very determined. We would rehearse every day. We would write songs every day. We just wanted to be the best band we could. And we would play, the occasional show along with, guys like, Rat and Motley Crue was playing the club still when we first came down. I saw them at the Troubadour. But they grew. They rose pretty quick. Quiet Riot did as well. And we were the third band signed out of everybody. It was first, Motley Crue, Quiet Riot, and Black and Blue was third.
Hey, Jamie, during that time, kind of when you guys were breaking right there, did anybody stick out to you that you're that these guys are really going to ascend?
Well, I knew Motley Crue would because they released that a single. I forget what was on it, "Toast of the Town" and something else. But I got the single, and I knew I had seen them, and I knew Motley Crue was going to do something, and I liked them a lot. The first record, I had the first version of it on Leather Records.
Oh, amazing.
And so I knew they were going to break. I always liked Rat a lot. Good songs. And they were friends. I mean, the first house we slept in, Robin Crosby was sleeping in the same house. We became friends with Juan Croucier, we'd loan him our bass gear. I think we had better gear than him, or he maybe his got ripped off or something. I don't know. I'll have to ask him. But we were, I knew Rat was good. As time went on, eventually around the 83, a Wasp was happening, and I thought, God damn, look at these guys. A Wasp was pretty cool.
Bunch of handsome lads.
Blackie was a big fan of Black and Blue. He came to all our shows, and after parties, we would always have a party at a hotel next door to like the Troub or whatever, down the street, and he would always be there. But it was good. It was good. There was a lot of good bands playing, and in that time period, that was the best time for me. A lot of bands started, tons of bands started coming to LA after 84, 85. But in the early days, there wasn't as many. And we were all good, actually. I liked Armored Saint a lot. Armored Saint
Oh,
was
yeah.
cool. A lot of good bands.
And like I said, that would seem like maybe later on. Was there a point where you're going, this is getting to be too many people here, this is getting too many musicians and overcrowded, or?
In the later 80s, there was so many bands playing, I couldn't keep track of them. There was just a ton of them because that's what happens, And everybody, could smell LA from anywhere in America. Say, that's where I'm going to get a record deal. And everybody came in. And the good bands got there, but there was so many bands that didn't make it, because it was a floodgate. The record companies, they're going to look for anything successful. They're going to look for something that's exactly like that. So it got saturated by the end, for sure.
I guess I'm guessing that a lot of bands maybe thought it was going to happen by osmosis, but you guys
Probably,
went.
and maybe some of them did, but they probably lasted a week at, some shitty label,
Right. So before we move on, you got any crazy story from the Starwood?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, I was there constantly back in the day. I can't remember no anything that really stand. I mean, okay, probably the craziest thing for me was in later on. I mean, probably in the '90s, early '90s. I think I ended up running into Sam Kinison, and I partied with Sam Kinison at his hotel room for a day or two.
So say you probably couldn't keep up with Sam. Nobody could.
Oh my God, he was insane, and he liked to talk, man. But it was a that was a nutty night. I'll never forget that. But yes, he was a great guy. It was amazing. He just walked up and said, "Who's in charge of this gang?" I am. And he says, "You're coming with me. Gather everybody up. We're going to party." I was like, "Okay." That was pretty nuts. But there's a lot of crazy nights at the Starwood. You know, it's a fun place. I mean, Rainbow. Talking about the Starwood earlier. Rainbow, yeah, fun place.
Right on. So we want to talk to you mostly about the Without Love record, because
okay,
to me, like, it was such a tremendous growth. And I'd like to, you know, if I can, like, we want to possibly do the deepest, most highly detailed deep dive into Without Love. And from, you know, obviously at some point, you know, you're making the second record, and right before it's a twinkle in your eye, if we can start from there, like, when did these songs start appearing?
Some of the songs, okay, it probably immediately after we finished the first record. We just were in a real writing mode, and we wanted to just get ahead of the game. So I think we just started as soon as we got back from the Aerosmith tour, because for the first record, we toured with Aerosmith. It was a Back in the Saddle tour when Joe Perry and Brad Whitford came back, and it was the original band again. And we toured two or three months with Aerosmith. And right when we got back from that, we did some occasional shows here and there. I think we went out with Dio for a little bit, and we did a few shows here and there, but we were locked ourselves away to write again. So we started writing songs, and we had to make a decision what we were going to do, who we wanted to work with, you know. And with Dieter, it was fun, but we had to go to Germany, and it was a lot of, you know, Dieter's is an amazing guy, but we thought we might want him to try something different. So really, while writing songs, we were researching who we would want to use. And I think our light man, Patrick Young's brother, Steve Young, brought up Bruce Fairburn, because he was listening to Loverboy. He says, these guys might have something. So we listened to that, and we said, you know, this might be a great combination. Him and Bob Rock, the record company, we went to John Colodner at a record company and said, we want to use this Bruce Fairburn guy. And he says, yeah, and Bob Rock. You got to have Bob Rock with him. So we that's what we just kind of decided. And wasn't a lot of people using him then. That was kind of a weird choice in a way. And we just ended up, we sent them demos. They accepted. So that was the beginning of what we knew, what we were going to go to Canada, to Little Mountain, and actually work with this dream team before it was a dream team. Mike Fraser, who went on to be a huge engineer, did many big records, was our second engineer. So it was a dream team back then. After John Bon Jovi heard that record, he used that same team for Slippery When Wet. So we were right anyway. So we would just write songs. And I don't know, one of the first songs we had written was, we called it Rock and Roll Animals. And we played it in Japan when we went to Japan to play. But when we got back and we took it to Canada, we changed it to Rockin' on Heaven's Door. And so that was probably one of the first songs that we wrote for that record.
How did that change come about? Is that just all you guys just...
I think Bruce Fairburn didn't like animals. He wanted to see, can you say something else, you know? And then I came up with, yeah, we were kind of, I was, back then me and Tommy were twisting titles around, you know, like Nature of the Beach, Nature of the Beast, you know, we said the Nature of the Beach, made it a beach thing. And I thought Rockin' on Heaven's Door, we'll try that, you know? And instead of Knocking on Heaven's Door. Right, so I just thought that was a cool title. And that's the way we went with it. But Bruce instigated it. He said, can you try to change that for me, Jamie? And whenever I had some kind of lyric that was really mean and you know, just was kind of raw, he'd want to brighten it up a little bit. So
do you you think that sound kind of evolved, influenced by Bruce as well and Bob Rock? Or did you know?
Well, those guys pushed, you know, the record company told those guys, we want to get these guys on the radio. Of course, that's what record companies do. So we had that battle of back and forth, you know, we want to be black and blue, but we're gonna, you know, but we want to, you know, these guys are pushing us in a direction to get us on the radio because that's, they want success, you know? And honestly, so do we. Here's the thing. Tommy and I can write any kind of a song. We can write a song that sounds like a Motorhead if we want, and we can write a song that sounds like Cheap Trick. So we are very versatile. And that's why our records have so many different styles on them. It's all rock, but I never wanted to hold back. If it's a good song, it's a good song. I don't care. You know, and a good song to me had a great riff. It was and a great melody and some good lyrics, you know. So when we went down that road, it was easy for us to try to write some stuff that had a little bit more, I'm just going to use its bad word, but commercial sound, you know.
Mm-hmm. I always love Nature of the Beach. I remember having a crush on this girl in high school that was like two grades above me. And like, that's never going to happen. So that song was always kind of my soundtrack to that feeling.
That's a great song. I mean, I love the way that song came out because that was pretty raw. You know, the riff, I can't remember, me and Tommy put together the riff. And it with the time we got done with it up in Little Mountain in the studio, man, that thing came alive. I just went, wow, this really, what a song. I thought it was great. I mean, Juan Cruce from Rat told me, he says, anybody that can write a song like Nature of Beach is a great band in my book. You know, it came out really well.
It is really a kind of a, to me, it's a summer record because a buddy of mine in the same grade, like that was the summer after our sophomore year in high school that we listened to Without Love over and over and over and over, cruising up and down the strip in the town we lived in trying to get chicks and stuff. So that was just a great, like I said, Miss Mystery, Nature of the Beach. It was just such a great, great soundtrack to our teenage years.
An interesting note, there's another song on the record called Swing Time. Right. And Swing Time was not called Swing Time. We wrote, that was another first one that we wrote. And it was called Blame It on the Neighborhood. That's what it was called. And we took it to Geffen and John Kladner is like, I love this song. I hate the title. We love the title. But he said that we're not calling it that. See, this is what record companies do to you, you know. Well, we got $300,000 we're going to put into this record. So you change the title, you know. Or we're not, you know, or you're in trouble, you know. Why should we give you the money if you don't do what we say? You know, it was a feeling I got, you know. But so we said, okay, so we changed the title. But it was called Blame It on the Neighborhood. And that was another one that was very early on in the songwriting process for that record. And when we got there, Bruce was, you know, we got to change it. You know, the record company won't put it on the record. It's not going on the record called that. What do you do? You know?
Yeah.
So I came up with a Swing Time idea, you know, and I started putting all these big band phrases in there and stuff, thinking I could try to make it into something, you know. And I tried to, it sounded like Swing Time because the music, dude, I thought, okay, big band kind of stuff could, you know, see you later, alligator, I say, and that kind of thing, you know. So, you know, that was an early on the song. I had been working in my head on a song called Miss Mystery before we were going up there. And I had the chorus. I was singing the chorus in my head exactly how it is on the record. Because I thought Miss Mystery, I was coming up, I was playing around. I always played with titles and I was thinking Mr. something. And I go, Mr. Miss Misdemeanor. No, that sucks. And I said, Miss Mystery. And so when we got up there, we got Bruce Fairbairn hooked us up with Jim Vallance, who's an amazing songwriter, writes all the stuff with Bryan Adams, all the early Bryan Adams hits and that thing. So we went to his house and he's like, you know, they were playing around with stuff and they go, does anybody, you guys got any ideas? And Tommy didn't even know it. I said, I got an idea. It's called Miss Mystery. And I started singing it, the chorus, exactly how it is on the record. And Tommy just started playing the chords. And within 2 minutes, Jim just said, that's what we're working on right there. You know, so that was how that song was developed in his basement studio up in Canada.
Yeah, so like played I said, all the time, Brian. I hear it all the time.
Yeah. Like I said, that's the message I got in that song was like I said, having a crush on a girl that's just completely out of reach. It's like, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. it just made sense to me, Miss Mystery, you know, and here you are so far from me, you know, you want this girl, but it's just not happening, you know, so I can relate to that, right?
I can relate to it really well, unfortunately.
And Bruce said, what are you saying? Why are you saying here you are so far from me? What do you mean? I go, come on, it's old Susanna. It was so hot, I froze to death. Susanna, don't you guys? It's cool, Bruce. And he goes, oh, I get it. You know, he's Canadian. He never heard that song.
Do you think the songs like that, where you're yearning for somebody but you don't obtain them, resonates more with people than the songs where you get what you're after?
I think so. I think people like to dwell on that kind of thing, you know? I think so. You know, I love, you know, stuff like that. I do.
I do too. So,
Yeah, I think people connect to it pretty easily.
I agree with you. It seems like it's almost more nostalgic in that case.
And so, yeah, that was a no-brainer once that was put together. That was a solid song we worked quite a bit on. I believe we had some of the, there's some little, you can hear keyboards in that. We would never wanted to go heavy on keyboards because we're not a keyboard band, but there is some keys in there that was done by the keyboard player from Loverboy. Doug was his name, I think. And a little, also there was some keys done by David Page and Picaro from Toto. They came in
Oh
and helped.
shit. Wow.
Some of the weird sounds, like I think it's Without Love, the song. That's, is his name Steve Picaro, the keyboard player Picaro. He's doing all these weird
Yeah.
sounds. His Toto guys came in and killed it, you know. They were
Dude.
just really cool stuff.
The Toto guys were like the band of the 70s and 80s, where, like, I'm talking the band, like Levon Helm band. Like, they were initially backing and did all the stuff for people, and then people didn't realize how freaking good musicians they were on their
My
own
God,
right
they
until
were
they did
so
it on their
cool.
own. Yeah, man.
We were
Holy
lucky to get them.
crap.
They happened to be playing in Vancouver, Canada, and Bob Rock got a hold of them and said, "Can you come in and do some work with these guys?" And it was so cool to get them.
Damn.
Before we got on, Jason and I were talking about the drum sound of the record. And then I had said earlier today I'd heard Wherever I May Roam, and it's like that drum sound and the drum sound on Dr. Feelgood. Was did Bob Rock specifically work on that drum sound on Without Love, or was
No, Bob Rock did it. He created that drum sound and worked on it for 2 or 3 days. The key was we set the drums up in the main room. There's a main, there used to be, I don't know if it's still there, but there was the big studio room. And then there's a huge room next door that's just a big empty concrete room. And he put plywood up and did all this stuff and directed the sound and put mics out in that big empty concrete room. And they blended tones together. It took 2 or 3 days to get it right, but hell of a drum sound. And yeah, that was the first thing we did. And I was involved with all that because I always helped Pete. I used to be a drummer, so I would tune Pete's drums. I'd help him. We didn't bring a drum tuner, and I would do it, or me and Pete would work on it together. We got dialed in that sound really good, and that's all Bob Rock. It's all Bob Rock and Little Mountain Studio combined. You get a killer sound, man.
To me, the test for music is listening in the car. And when I listen to Without Love in the car, it's just right there. The drums are just fucking just right there. I just love it.
Yeah,
It's
they're
awesome.
insanely good. I mean, that's what Bon Jovi and Richie Sambora heard. They told me, both of those guys, to my face, that's why we used those guys, was we put your cassette on and it blew away our last CD, the sound. So th yeah, those that that it look, it ended up everybody used those guys. Aerosmith, I mean, it went nuts up there. So, but we were really kind of the first ones to bring that. Look, after Bon Jovi did it with Slippery When Wet, who's not going to use them?
That's right. But I guess for you guys, you helped Bob Rock and all those guys tune their sound to what they took with them later on. And this that record, your record sounds incredible.
We had, the good news was we had Geffen did put the money into us to be able to do that. So forever grateful for that, because I now have that album for the rest of my life, that I, that's part of my life. So I'm very grateful. We could have took a ton of money and put it in the bank. We spent every penny on that thing, and I'm still glad we did it. It's a lot of money, but it was worth it because we were always that way. Everything goes back into the to Black and Blue. Let's make it the best we can. So I still love that record too. It's my favorite Black and Blue record. I think the only mistake was releasing This Mystery first. Could have released something else to not be such a shock from a change from the first album.
Did you guys have a debate over that with a record company of which single should be released? Like, were you guys lobbying for something else?
But it didn't matter what we said. They were going to do what they wanted to do. We had no friggin' say in it, which is really sad and weird, but that's what it is. And I would not have released that song first. Although I love the song, I would have released anything other than that. There's a song called, the song called Without Love, the title track could have even been better because it had a more, it was a more guitar, a little bit, a little rougher than Miss Mystery. Miss Mystery is almost a ballad, And I think it was a shock from Hold On to 18 and Auto Blast,
Well, the formula too, especially in the 80s with hard rock and metal, was first song is a hard song, kind of get your attention. The second song comes the ballad.
Yeah. I mean, that was the way it went usually. And I'm surprised they did it that way. They just released Miss Mystery and that is it. You know, it's sink or swim on that song, which it did pretty well. I mean, I know I used to look at the R&R report and stuff, and we were getting a ton of airplay. MTV was playing it and all that stuff. But I think we would have been better served to release something else first. But, you know, that's the way that goes. Now, just speaking about Without Love, the song, that came together completely different than a usual Black and Blue song. Jim Vallance wrote all that music. He just brought a tape in and said, I got this music. Can you do something with it? So I took it and wrote Without Love, wrote the lyrics and melodies and everything. So that's just a Jim Vallance and me song. And I think it came out pretty good. Yeah, I mean, the guys loved it. I mean, Fairburn just loved it. You know, it's like, man, wow.
I can hear it in my head right now when you're talking, because when you say, I can hear Without Love, like, I can just, it's in my head still.
Yeah. Well, Bruce loved it. And they were like, man, we got another Jim, you know. And, you know, I can't remember the other earlier songs. I think Stop the Lightning came on along fairly early, because we would write these songs, take them to Geffen, and they would send them to Bruce and Bob. So they could get prepared. And yeah, it's a great experience. So much fun, you know, fun time in my life for sure. See, to hear those songs come alive like they did, it's a thrill.
How do you reconcile that as a young band and you know you have to concede to the record company and you know your instincts are probably right?
Yeah, it's terrible because we were with a guy who does have good instincts, John Kolodner. You know, he signed AC/DC, he signed Foreigner. He knows what he's hearing. But I think even he had trouble fighting for us at Geffen. The higher ups there would make decisions and they didn't know what they were talking about. So we had a good guy on our side, but still decisions were made above him. And I don't know, it's just kind of strange. Why wouldn't you trust the guys you signed? I mean, we're creating this sound, right? You know, we know what we're doing, but it's just the way it is. It's the sad part about getting a record deal, you know? And look, I wouldn't change anything because now I think things are really screwed. You know, I mean, there is no record company to speak up for a band like us. It doesn't exist the way we did it, the way we got successful, the way we quote made it. That's, you know, anything else you want to know about Without Love album?
Well, yeah, just a couple more things. Like, you know, it's my favorite Black and Blue record as well. And because it's you guys, but it's, I think it's your record that's got the most stylistic different things on it. I mean, I love Strange Things. Like, how did that come about? That's like,
that is a killer song. That is one of my favorite Black and Blue songs. And that was a thing that Tommy was playing around with those chords, if I remember right. And I could hear the sound of it. And I go, oh man, I want to do kind of an Alice Cooper sounding thing with this or something, you know? And Strange Things was, I don't know I came up with the lyrics just kind of with Alice Cooper in mind, you know? And the coolest thing about that song, well, it just came together, and I'm the one that screamed for I Want Cellos. And that's a da-da-da-da-da-da-da in there. I forced that and nobody heard it. And finally, Bob Rock goes, I know what he's doing. I get it. I get it now. And it's a strange, the Queen thing. I said, pan it. We got to do Queen. And Bruce was like going, what are we doing here? And Bob Rock got it. He says, I know what he's trying to do. Just let him do it. And so that's one of my favorite songs. I think one of the cool things is we went to another studio in Canada to just do work on vocals. And we would record layers and layers of vocals and then on another tape and then fly it in because you could conserve tracks that way, you know? So we'd have a half inch tape that we just layered a bunch of vocals on. So that's cool. I could do all that Queen stuff. That's all me. This is a ton of me, you know, with those backgrounds. And we flew it into to where it needed to be at the end of the song. And then the song stopped. And then this old man on a piano started singing. It was an accident. If you listen to the song at the very end, there's a goal. And I go, what the hell is that? And we're all just listening. And it fades out exactly like it does on the record. I said, do not lose that. Save that. That is perfect. Don't touch it. And it was like the weirdest thing that happened. It was a guy that used to pay him money to go into this littler studio and record himself playing piano and singing. He's singing Danny Boy. Oh, Danny Boy. And it's at the end of Strange Things. I go, what could top that song off better than that? It was an accident. The guy doesn't even know he's on a record.
My buddy and I, we couldn't figure out if that was the end of Strange Things or the beginning of this last song I want to talk about. As the All Things Blues and Southern Rock podcast, Two Wrongs Don't Make a Love, that's a blues song. How does that make it? How does that get? I love that song, man.
That is a great song, and that was something that I think Tommy kind of instigated that one, and we just it's a different sound of the song for Black and Blue. Some people think it's like their favorite song. I know a couple of people that go, I love that song. Yeah, it's a great song, and it was I think the last one we brought to the table, and it made the cut. You know, different for us in a way, but I thought it was really good. It's cool. When it's one of those ones one of these days we need to throw it in a live set because we haven't played that. I don't ever played it live.
Isn't that not a reflection of Tommy's playing? Because when you guys were in LA, it seems like Tommy's the only guy that's not doing the acrobatics. You know, he's Tommy like a blues-based player.
Completely. Tommy was influenced by Eric Clapton, Ace Frehley, Ronnie Montrose. He's an old-school player, you know, and he plays a blue. Listen, Tommy Thayer is one of the best guitarists I've ever played with. Let me tell you something. The guy is a rhythm machine. He is so perfect in the studio and live. I mean, he can just, he's very on the spot. He doesn't waver. He's rock solid. You can count on him anytime. And he's not the flashy Eddie Van Halen type guitarist. Mm-hmm. Never was. But he's a solid blues guy, you know. For me, that's what made Black and Blue a little different because he wasn't trying to do all that stuff. And he shouldn't have, you know. He didn't want to change what he was.
Right on. Well, we want to talk just a little bit about your Cheap Trick tribute band. How did that come about? And is that, it seems like it's like, that's almost kind of the thing where that's really helping, you know, pay the bills or, you know, like I have a friend in North Dakota here farther west, and she does shows, but she says, you got to have a theme, and they'll do like a British Invasion night. Now they're doing like an Allman Brothers kind of thing. So is that like, how did your Cheap Trick tribute band come about?
Honestly, the reason why I do it, why I will even do it is for my voice, because I don't sing enough. Black and Blue doesn't play as much as we used to. I mean, we still have shows, you know, we still fly out and do an occasional festival, the cruises, Monsters of Rock cruises we do every year. We're doing it again next year in 2024. And we'll do a club run here and there if it's right, you know, but I don't sing enough. So I sing in this Cheap Trick cover. It's called A Cheaper Trick. And we make okay money. It's kind of crazy. A lot of bands make decent money at that. But I do it not just for the money. I do it because I get to sing more. I have to sing because I took a year off once, maybe during the COVID thing. I didn't sing at all. And my voice was not strong. It's just like working out or something. If you don't keep singing, it goes away. And I didn't have the stamina. I didn't have the strength in my voice. So, you know, that's something that I have to keep doing. Also, a year ago, I quit drinking, and that helped a lot too.
Right on.
No more alcohol to mess up my voice. So I'm in the top of my game, actually. I'm 63, and I can sing better than ever. But I'm lucky. I can still sing everything I wrote in Black and Blue in the original key. No problem. Even the high stuff, Nasty Nasty, Get Wise or Eyes, all that stuff. I can sing it all. So, but by doing these tribute thing, it keeps my voice in shape. I heard Roger Daltrey say once, I'm afraid to stop singing because afraid if I do, it'll never come back. And he's right. Yeah. At our age.
Yeah.
At his age. Shit, I ain't as old as him.
Well, like our age too, like, you know, I'm almost 50, and if I were to get out of shape, it would be a lot harder to get back into shape working out now than if I stopped. And it's the same thing, like you said, exactly with your voice. You don't know or how long it's going to take you to get back when you get older.
Yeah, it's true. And I found it out, and it took me a while to get back, and I'm fine. But it took a lot of rehearsals. And I go, man, after I do a 2-hour rehearsal, and an hour in, I'm going, I don't know if I can keep singing. It was like, you know, so I have to do a 90-minute set or something, you know. So I had to you got to keep your voice in shape. So that's great for me. I mean, I just did a rehearsal last night for 3 hours, I sang, you know. It's awesome.
Right on. Well, Jason, is it that time of the show? Jamie, do you have time for a lightning round?
Shoot me. Let's go.
All right. We're going to go and we're going to ask you some stupid questions. So don't be offended. All right. What is your favorite tour that you're ever on?
Aerosmith.
Is there anything song-wise that stood out to you that they had performed that just really got you?
Yeah. In the field, put the mule in the stable. That one.
Last Child.
Last Child. Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, I thought you're. I didn't know you were looking for the answer. I thought you were just thinking
of. It might have been Moving On too. It kind of sounded like you're doing Moving on the first record.
No, that was Last Child. They would go into that thing, and God, the groove on that. They were so great. Also, they opened up with Back in the Saddle. It's a great song.
Ah, yeah. Fuck, man. Aerosmith was one of my first love bands. I love those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Aerosmith. Here's a thing for you, but real quick.
Yeah.
I'm on tour with Aerosmith and I'm talking to Steven Tyler. And I said, listen, I saw you guys. I think it was 73 or 74 open for Three Dog Night. And he goes, whoa, that was the first time we were ever on the West Coast. And you were there and now you're opening for me. I go, you're damn right I am. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Blown away by that. I was 13.
They were my first real concert, 1987. I went and saw them, Permanent Vacation Tour with Guns N' Roses opening.
Nice. Yeah.
Right? Before Great band. Everybody knew who they were. Yeah. Yeah. What's one band kind of from you guys got started there that you were surprised never really gained a foothold?
Black and Blue.
Me too. Brian and I, obviously we're doing a Southern Rock and Blues based podcast, but we always gravitated towards the bluesier, blues influenced rock bands at the time, you know, Junkyard, you guys, Cinderella, you know, you name it. Like those were always what we dug. Tesla.
Oh yeah. Tesla, great band. They were on Geffen. I those guys, great guys. No, I know all those guys and what a great bunch of guys and great band.
All right. You said you quit drinking. So what's a guilty pleasure snack, treat, drink, or something for you these days?
Oh, a guilty snack is gonna be ice cream and popsicles.
Oh yeah. You got favorite flavor or favorite shop?
I eat Tillamook ice cream like it's going out of style. Every night I got to have a little bit of it. I don't eat too
That's
much.
That's Portland, right? That's Portland.
That's or Oregon. I'm throw down for Oregon there. Yeah, Tillamook ice cream. Just ask my wife. That's all I eat.
It is good stuff. Are they just dairy? Do they have a brewery as well?
Oh, they make cheese.
Cheese, that's what it is.
Yes. A little cheese is big cheese too. But anyway, I kind of guilty about it. I like to have a little ice cream. I don't need a lot, but a little bit every night. I just have to have some. So yeah.
Nothing wrong with that, man. You know, you gotta have a little something, something.
Let's live. Pizza and ice cream.
all the foundations to, you know, the food pyramid. Pizza and ice cream.
Yeah, I'm a wild rocker. I eat Tillamook ice cream.
it's amazing these days. We talked to anybody from up and coming artists to well established, you know, like you guys, and how the scenes and everybody does. Everybody's a lot more healthy. It's a different world these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I did all that stuff. I've done everything you could want to do back when I was young. That guy is still alive, so I'm gonna keep him that way.
We want you to keep them that way. Are you more of a reader or like a streamer of movies and TV?
Probably more of a streamer. I love streaming like anybody else, the Netflix stuff, you know, or whatever. I like to find a good one that I can. I mean, I just recently, everybody kept telling me to watch Walking Dead. I never did. And I finally caught a hold of it and I watched the whole thing from start to finish, you know? Yeah. I like you know, that kind of stuff. My wife and I.
Yeah. You like the horror stuff?
I do. I like horror stuff, you know, but I never did a lot of that in my past. So, I mean, recently I just, about a year ago, 2 years ago, I watched the whole Sopranos thing. I never had seen it. Great, great deal. So that was fun for me. I did the same thing with Breaking Bad. I never saw it and I just, it's already done. So I just watched the whole thing. It took me a couple weeks, you know, but I love doing that. Yeah. I don't read a lot. I'm dyslexic and my eyes are bad, so reading is painful to me. So
Yeah.
I don't, yeah.
What kind of stuff do you like best, though? So you're talking about streaming, you know, you've got some sci-fi horror, some drama. Do you gravitate towards anything specifically, or just like whatever's good?
I think whatever's good, and I do like sci-fi horror stuff a lot, you know, but if it's good, it's good. I mean, I'm one of those guys. I loved Ozark. Great, well done, you know. I mean, I love that. And it's funny, the drummer in A Cheaper Trick edited the Ozark. He's an editor for that. He
Oh, no
tells me
shit.
about it. Yeah, his name's Kevin Valentine, great drummer. He's in Donny Iris' band, and he played on Cinderella record. He played on a couple Kiss records. He's a great drummer. Yeah.
Yeah, what I like about streaming and a lot of these series now are the fact that, one, they don't overdo the season. So you're doing 8, 10, 12 episodes. And then they don't have so many seasons, too, where it gets redundant and ridiculous. You know what I mean? Like they can tell a cohesive, tight story and be done with it.
Yeah. And I think it's the kind of the way they, I mean, I like the whole format. I think it's great, you know.
I do
And I
too.
like the idea that I can keep watching, or I can say that's enough for tonight, you know. It's kind of cool. I mean, you're in control. But yeah, I mean, I love all that stuff.
It's easy though to say, do you want to keep watching and click that yes, and next thing you know, you're up all night watching a stupid series.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I watch with my wife, and it's like, are we done? No, one more, one more. I go, yeah, all right.
What my wife always does. Brian, does your wife do that too if you're streaming
Oh, yeah.
something? And like she's the bad influence. All right, we'll move on. So Portland, not necessarily, like, what was the music scene like in Portland when you guys were getting going? Because I don't see necessarily Portland in the 70s as like a huge like musical mecca.
No, there's very few rock bands that have broke out of Portland. When I was growing up, it was all cover bands, you know, and there were big cover bands, you know, in town, but you never heard of them. And I started out playing high school dances and then graduated to clubs. I play in clubs before I was old enough to get in. They just made me sit on the stage and I
Yeah.
could play. But it was all cover bands, you know, and every now and then a band would play original music, but it was, you know, it just no, nobody ever broke out of there. I knew we could. I mean, Tommy Thayer tells me, you know, up to this day, thank you so much for taking me out of there, because I would have never done it. You know, I had the dream. I said, we're gonna go to it. It's not gonna come to us here. So yeah, Portland was a weird place to play, but in the 70s there were a lot of clubs that we could play, and into the 80s. And so we did that. We played 4 nights a week, 4 sets a night, playing whatever covers. I mean, I was in a band before Black and Blue. We were called Movie Star. Tommy Thayer was in that. I was the drummer. And I was a singing drummer, but we had a bass player that sang too. And it was all cover tunes. But we were still writing original music constantly. We're recording and writing, and we never stopped that. So a lot of bands were just happy to play that club scene and, you know, make a few dollars, and that was what they did. Not me. Yeah.
I'm a big Warrant guy. I loved Warrant. Screw anybody who didn't think Warrant was great. Jamie Lane was a great songwriter. You fronted Warrant for a little bit. Is there a particular song that you just really love singing?
Yeah, well, I was in Warrant for about 4 years, almost 4 years.
Yeah.
And when I was in the band, Janie was still alive, actually. I think he caught us, saw us once or twice. But yeah, Janie's an excellent songwriter. And I know Janie. He was a great guy. He was very talented. And I like Warrant a lot. If I didn't like him, I wouldn't have joined the band when they asked me. But yeah, well, I liked a lot of songs. I'm trying to think back. Uncle Tom's Cabin was always fun to sing. I liked that one. I love the Dog Eat Dog album, which
Oh, I was going to say, that's my favorite Warrant record. That's so good.
we tried a bunch of songs. We did April 2031. We did Machine Gun.
Oh.
We did we tried a bunch of songs off that, and they would never go over too well at the shows because, you know, not enough people knew them. And Eric Turner would always say, we're pulling it. You know, but
Yeah.
what a great album. I liked a lot of songs. There was quite a few songs I loved singing with those guys. There's great songs, you know.
Dude, completely talented guy. He knew how to write hooky stuff.
Yeah, for sure, you know. And Hey, they're still alive today with, you know, because of all that music. They're still playing and touring. And you know, Robert Mason's a great singer, and they're in good shape. Yeah.
80s was a big time for music videos, and I know Warrant had their cheesy cherry pie video. What do you think is the most cringy music video of the 80s?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I love Dawn, but that Break of the Chains video is hideous. I'm sorry, Dawn. I love you.
There is a video that ruined a guy's hot career in the 80s.
Billy Squier.
A really good artist. Rock Me Tonight by Billy Squier.
And you know what?
He's like dancing in the room and he tears open his shirt.
He just looks kind of silly. But you know, but people forget, listen to the song. It's a cool song.
It's a great song.
It's a great song.
He had great songs
by that video.
That video is... I can't, like, I feel bad for him because he is a good singer and has good material. But
yeah, sure. I saw him when he was in Piper. Yeah,
he was supposed shit. To
set up at Salt Lake City to open up for Billy Squier. We were going to do a run. We were going to perform. This was 80, I don't remember, 85 maybe, and 4 even. And we were set up. The Salt Palace in Salt Lake City is packed. It's 20 minutes before the show, and they say the show is canceled. Canceled. Billy's not playing. And we never played with him. He didn't play. He has a situation. I had to go on the radio station that night and tell everybody that he broke a rib or something, but that wasn't true. I think it was he was locked in his room, maybe doing drugs or something. I don't know. Something bad was going on. So, I mean, he's better now, I'm sure. But, yeah, it was really bummer that we didn't get to do that tour. The whole tour got canceled. So.
My last question for you and the lightning or the, it's not really a lightning round because we expand on our
we slowed it down. Sorry, that's my fault.
No. We call it a lightning round because it's random questions, but it's always like this expansive answers, which are cool. So my last question for you here is, you know, that was a good story from your time on the road. Give it, like, if there's one story that really sticks out to you from all your time of performing, you know, start to now, like, what is it? Like, what really sticks out in your mind vividly?
There was a time when we were on our way. This is very early on. The record had been out for a while, and we were playing some clubs to get to the Aerosmith tour because it started in Little Rock, Arkansas. So we were in St. Louis.
That's a random place to start an Aerosmith tour.
Yeah, it is. That's where it started. And we were in St. Louis, Missouri, and we were supposed to play a little club called Mississippi Nights. I'll never forget it. And we were opening for Alvin Lee. Alvin Lee is from 10 years after. He was actually in Woodstock, you know. It was a weird thing to put us on. But we show up at this club. We've got a bus and a trailer full of gear, and we're like ready to go, man. We're going to take on the world. And we show up at this club, and this Alvin Lee's guy's got all the stuff taken up the whole stage. And they said, well, if you guys want to play, you go on down on the dance floor and set up down there. And we just told the club owner, we don't need to do this. Go to hell. We're not going to sit up on the floor. Screw you. And the guy said, you know, there's a line of kids, line of black and blue fans lined up around the club because they want to see us. They got records in their hands and everything. And we just felt bad. We said, well, sorry, guys, we'll sign your stuff, but we're not playing. And some kid says, well, we got a band. Talking about his band and said, where do you guys rehearse? He goes, in my basement. Let's go. And we went to the kid's basement. We played on their gear. We did our whole black and blue set for all these fans in that kid's basement. No
wow.
kidding.
Wow.
Yeah, we played for him anyway. And it was
how many people did he have down there? Did he have invited?
There was probably 30, 40 kids slammed in this kid's basement. That's it. And we did this shitty equipment and we cranked out the whole black and blue set for those people.
What an amazing night and experience for all those guys and for you guys to do that.
Yeah, they'll never forget it. That was awesome.
Fuck. Brian, what do you think about that?
Oh, that's definitely awesome. But so where do we go to find out anything that you got going on with yourself or Black and Blue? What's your social media? Where should we look for you?
Black and Blue, blackandblue.com still exists. You can go on our Facebook page. It's probably the most up-to-date stuff. There's a couple of Black and Blue Facebook, Black and Blue Official, Black and Blue. Just go on Facebook. There's two of them. I run one, and we have a girl named Kitty that runs the other one with Patrick Young. We have two. I don't know why, but we do. Find either one. It'll tell you what we're doing. And that's pretty much it, man. We don't play a whole lot, but when we get a chance, we will. I think this year, this next year in 2024, it's the 40-year anniversary of the first record. So we may do some club runs or something and play the whole record in its entirety in order, in the right order and everything. We're talking about doing that now. So that might be something to look for.
That would be amazing. I love that.
Yeah. Record. Well, 40 years, man. We should do that, you know, and of course we'll play other stuff at the end of the night. Monsters of Rock Cruise 2024, and I think March. And that's it, you know, just look for us on Facebook, maybe Twitter.
All right. Thank you so much, Jamie St. James. Like I said, my sophomore year of high school, and Without Love was the soundtrack. And thank you so much for coming on, man. It means a lot to us. Thank you.
I love that. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it so much. It means everything.
Thank you so much to Jamie St. James. That's kind of a dream come true for me. I mean, to get to talk to a guy that whose music I love so much and has so much influence on me, and was such a great, I keep repeating myself, the soundtrack to the summer of 86 for my sophomore year in high school. It's so weird. Like, I'll think back to that time, and it's like, obviously back then we don't know about the internet or any of this stuff was coming and podcasts and whatnot. So it was never like in my thought process, I'm going to talk to this guy someday, you know? So it's awesome.
So what did you learn again? Cause I told you in the intro, like this, it's exciting for me because you are so pumped up, you know, like you said, we're excited about all of our artists that we have on here, but this one has personal reverence to you. So like, what did you find out that you always wanted to know?
I felt like I got to hear a little bit more in detail about, how they came to doing these songs for Without Love, how they picked, you know, the producers, you know, listened to Loverboy, I guess, you know, and got to hear the story about them. They were going to open for Alvin Lee and ended up, you know, playing in some dude's basement, you know, just, it's kind of cool. Like just to hear the beginning of how that all started and, you know, them getting Jim Vallance on, who worked with Bryan Adams, and, you know, some of it, a lot of it I knew, but it's just, I just felt like it was like more in detail and more in depth and to talk to Jamie himself to tell me. So it was cool.
Well, how about Steve Picaro from Toto?
Yeah. And that's, and I remember like I had Without Love on cassette. I can probably still find it on CD somewhere. Someone's got it on eBay or something, but you know, when you're reading the liner notes, you know, Jim Vallance, Steve Picaro, I think Mike Reno from Loverboy sang on that. You know, when you look on Spotify for Without Love, it doesn't, the vast, last track on cassette is they covered Same Old Song and Dance by Aerosmith. You know, and Bob Rock played on that and some other folks. So
I'm always amazed every time I hear what Toto's or those guys from Toto have been involved with records. They're certainly, as I, you know, we're talking to Jamie, I'm like, they're kind of like the band of the 80s, and like, cause they played on so many records as the backing band that people don't have no idea.
Yeah. I'm sure I, you know, just go on Wikipedia and read all everybody they've worked with. And I think it's too, is it's a lot of it, at least for me, like getting older and having more open-minded to stuff. I mean, cause when I was getting into kind of metal in the early 80s, you know, at that time, you know, there was such, you know, in that the song Africa, that's Toto, right? And, you know, and I remember like at the same time, like Dexy's Midnight Runners had come on, Eileen, and you know, Steve Miller had did Abracadabra. I think it was all like around 82, 83, and got out of that kind of pop FM thing into heavy metal, you know, so I was kind of closed myself off from anything else. As I've gotten older, I'm like more going, yeah, man, these studio cats, you read that, you see that so much with studio musicians that are just spectacular. I mean, the Wrecking Crew, obviously the Swampers, you know, and I've also become more open to these country pickers, you know, like,
yeah,
like, oh my gosh, how good are they? So yeah, that's kind of the same kind of deal for sure.
So we marked something off your dream list of talking to Jamie St. James from Black and Blue. I love it. I love it. And I'm, it's true, man. It, when we, one of us gets pumped up or we get pumped up about a certain guest, it always makes me extra excited to talk to him too. It really does. It's fun.
Now, if we can only get Frank Hannon from Tesla. And Jamie talked about Tesla a little bit, which is cool.
Dude, we've talked about other, we've talked to people who thought that Frank Hannon would, you know, we're going to make it happen one of these days, Brian. People that we talked to seem to think it could happen. So I'm going to keep dreaming.
And as we keep dreaming, you guys always remember, Southern rock is reverent, blues is blood. We'll see you next time.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.